Kia ora, Claire Kincannon here from RNZ's Our Changing World. Join me in a new series, Voice of the Sea Ice, exploring Antarctic ice and science.
The grandiosity of the place and the size of the place, and just linking it back to the rest of the planet, that this place down at the bottom of the world that no one really thinks about will have a massive impact on us all.
Follow and listen to Voice of the Sea Ice wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There's a serious issue with the way we store our digital data. I'll let Domenico Viscinanza explain. Domenico is an Associate Professor of Intelligent Systems and Data Science at the UK's Anglia Ruskin University.
The worldwide data center demand is growing at a rate of at least 20% every year. And according to the International Energy Agency, data centers alone account for between 1 and 2% of global energy use, a massive amount of energy. But not just that, it's not just running them. Computers are using a lot of energy to do computations, but they also generate quite a lot of heat. That means that we need to find ways to take this heat away, to cool them down. And believe it or not, sometimes there is more energy spent to cool the servers and the data centers down than even to run them. So sometimes the cooling power and the cooling energy are even larger than the amount of energy that is required to run them.
And there's no easy fix, because no matter where on Earth you choose to build a data storage center, you're still going to run into the same issue over energy usage. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. But what if you went off Earth? What if you built a data storage facility on the moon, say, or on a satellite? That may sound odd, but as it turns out, it's a serious proposition. And it's our focus today on the program. The pros, the cons, and the reality of offshoring our data. Seriously offshoring, that is.
I think space is quite attractive for free energy. So it's having solar panels on a satellite like the moon, for example, would guarantee like absolutely free, unregulated energy supply forever. And of course, what is also attracting for this point of view is that in space is quite cold. And so cooling is definitely not an issue if you are thinking about building a data center on the moon's surface, for example. So no cooling, free energy, no planning permissions at the moment. That's, you know, all brilliant positive ticks for anything interested in building a massive amount of computing farms that require a lot of energy, lots of cooling, and a lot of space.
Now, various companies and organizations are already exploring the potential of space-based data storage.
Well, probably the most famous one is the Florida-based company called Lone Star Data Holdings. And what they did, they launched a shoebox size, so like a little, you know, tiny device, 8 terabytes of storage, you know, as big as a laptop. So it's a really, really tiny little scale. And the idea is to do a proof of concept, and after a couple of years, like, you know, 2027, starting launching a bunch of satellites between the Earth and the Moon in a very special place called Lagrange Point L1, which is a gravitational stable point between the Moon and the Earth. So a point that is at the right distance, not to fall towards the Earth or the Moon. So it's at the right balance, you know, to be really imbalanced, stable there. You know, why doing that? Because, of course, we are in space, so we, you know, even if we don't have to go on the moon's surface, this one is a satellite in space, but it's the first satellite dedicated to data processing and actually be a mini data center floating in space. They are thinking about launching a little constellation, or array or group of satellites that can do data processing. That is their starting point. It's a way to start exploring having things in space.
A small start, sure. But as they say, from little things, big things grow. And it isn't only the Americans who believe in the possibility of a lunar or orbiting data cloud. The European aerospace conglomerate Thales Alenia is also undertaking research, and the prototype data center that they're planning is significantly larger. Its space systems architect is Damien Demestier, who recently conducted a feasibility study funded by the EU.
So what we have proposed is quite big. It is 200 meters long by 80 meters large. It is twice the size of the International Space Station, but very, very thin. In fact, it is very, very light. And so the idea is to deploy this thanks to a super heavy launcher. And regarding the difficulties, it is right that it is currently difficult, but we are performing some studies to develop new technologies for assembly using robotics, developing a system where everything is launched stacked together. Then a robotic worker assembles it piece by piece, one in orbit.
At the moment, though, I feel duty-bound to point out, there isn't actually a launcher big enough to propel that amount of equipment into space. But Damien de Mistier is undeterred.
So this launcher should be a big one, bigger than current generation, but our solution is based on very close to maturation technology. And so in order to build or to deploy this data center, we consider that we could initiate the move by 2030 and to have the first large-scale space data center by 2035.
And what about the economics involved in this? Did your study look at the economic viability?
Yes. The main point is considering it is easy to build an Earth data center compared to space data center, but during their operation life, they are consuming a lot of energy, which have high cost. With space data center, the launch have a higher cost, but we do not spend any money on energy consumption during operation. So we save a lot of money. And so it is economically viable.
There is a lot of concern at the moment about space debris and about overcrowding in space because of the numbers of satellites that have been put up in the last decade and a half. How would that factor into considerations in terms of risk?
This is a good point, but the orbit that we have selected, the 1,400 kilometer altitude orbit, sits above most of space debris population, which limits collision risk. And the infrastructure itself, even if it's large, actually has a smaller footprint than some alternative from other companies. And in terms of all of that, it limits the risk of collision. We have what we call modularity. We have several modules, several ties, so it's easy to perform maintenance and to repair, in fact, in case of collision. And in the frame of the overall space ecosystem, we are developing a servicing capacity. First of all, to remove debris, we are working on that with the European Space Agency, but also to avoid debris collisions.
Orbiting data centers, its proponents also point out, could help improve the efficiency of space-to-space data transfer, and that in future could be useful for all manner of spacecraft and space activity. So even if the majority of our data farms remain cemented on Earth, the argument for orbiting data centers, they say, still stacks up. But despite the enthusiasm from business and the research community, Domenico Vishinanza from Anglia Ruskin University isn't convinced the reality will match the ambition.
First of all, it's quite expensive to send things in space. We can send supplies to our International Space Station, to other satellites, even send supplies to the moon. But that is really, really expensive. And when we are talking about data centers, we think about enormous, really big piece of machinery, like the equivalent of a few stories full of equipment that needs to be shipped in space. Then they need to be assembled. They need to be connected. They need to be maintained. And if anything goes wrong here on planet Earth, we can just send a technician, an engineer, and fix it. But if something breaks on the moon, we need to send engineers, also astronauts, that needs to go on the moon and need to do the repair. And that case, you can imagine, is incredibly, incredibly expensive. Also, any technology has a limited lifespan. So after a while, this service becomes obsolete and needs to be replaced. And that is an incredibly difficult job to do on the moon, because you need to dispose of the old one, you need to bring new one there. Solar panels, yes, they're brilliant, but with time, they become less and less efficient and eventually it needs replacing. So any maintenance, anything that requires a human intervention is incredibly difficult and expensive.
Domenico Vishinanza. Another question to contend with is effective regulation. If countries and companies do start launching their own data centres in space, how will they be coordinated and controlled? the current conventions around activity in space are really a patchwork of national and international agreements. Stephen Freeland is an expert on space law. He's an emeritus professor at Western Sydney University and a professorial fellow at Bond University.
There are so many new activities, and the idea of data centres in space or on the moon is certainly an activity that was not contemplated when this treaty regime was put together. So, yes, the fundamental principles will apply, cooperation, adherence to law, peaceful purposes, not disturbing others' freedom of access. This liability regime will apply, the authorization regime will apply. But as we do new things, obviously we will need additional regulation in addition to these fundamental principles that are more specific to these new type of ideas, because the private sector, for example, that will be involved in the data centres wants to have as much certainty, and that's a word in inverted commas because nothing is certain in space. There are always risks and variables, but they want to have certainty, and so there will be additional laws, and the notion of data centres adds some complications. It becomes a very complex picture.
Should we be concerned that some of the big tech and space-related companies in the United States are now openly expressing antipathy toward regulation and governance? And certainly the administration there in the United States also has talked about getting rid of regulation and governance. Is that a concern for the rest of the world?
That's a concern in a whole range of areas. I mean, there is a UN body based in Vienna called the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. At the moment, it's got 104 member states, but growing all the time. And every country there is concerned that they adhere to, as the cornerstone of everything, these treaties. Of course, to the extent countries or the private enterprise begin to criticize regulation, that could raise issues if they actually act on it. Perhaps 10 or so years ago, there was the beginnings of a movement in the United States by some to actually withdraw from this treaty regime because it was perceived at the time by the United States as restricting perhaps its ability to maintain its role as the chief space power. If they were to act on that now, that would be very, very disappointing. It would be a drastic step. Of course, there's concern, but I've had the privilege of talking, as I do in my role as chairing all of these countries, to all of the delegations one-on-one, as well as in meetings of all of them. I've recently had discussions with the United States delegation, and whilst, of course, they themselves are still grappling with the change of administration from the previous Biden administration to the current one, I've seen nothing that would indicate that, notwithstanding the rhetoric of the private sector, nothing that would lead to such a drastic step. And in fact, my own view is that it would be actually very contrary to their own or any country's interest to withdraw from that, because others would no longer trust them. The others would have a clear set of rules and they would have the ability to enforce those rules. And the country that withdraws would sort of be on its own. And space is so difficult and complex and now, of course, quite competitive that to try to do things solely on your own in space without alliances from other countries that would still be within the system would be extremely difficult. So it's concerning, the rhetoric, but I'm cautiously optimistic that it wouldn't be translated into an actual withdrawal from these fundamental frameworks.
So in summary, according to Professor Freeland, the existing protocols and treaties relating to space still function effectively. But given what we've seen with the exponential growth in satellites in recent years, is there a need for new arrangements and new agreements?
We will have additional regulation now, whatever form that takes. So, for example, I am the chair of all of the discussions on the legal aspects of space resource activities. You know, the idea, and this is still somewhat futuristic, the idea that perhaps we might exploit minerals or water on the moon or Mars or asteroid. We've heard many, many discussions about that as a possibility. And I'm being appointed by the UN to chair those discussions. And we now have a draft set of principles, which I was asked by the member states to prepare. I've done that. It's now with the member states. We now have essentially 2 years to negotiate that document. And obviously, the decision will be the member states, which is the 104 plus countries. The decision will have to be by consensus. So every country will have to agree. But hopefully, that process, which might then be endorsed by the United Nations General Assembly, will be additional guidelines, principles over and above the fundamental framework. So yes, we're going to have more regulation, as I say, as we do more and more in space, but that is necessary. If you think from the other perspective, imagine, for example, if we talk about space resource activities on the moon, at the moment, the great interest is particularly the projected water deposits and ice deposits in the south polar regions of the moon. And, you know, the major spacefaring countries supported by others like Australia are very interested in seeing what is possible. But imagine this scenario, if we had different groups of countries and their companies trying to do the same thing, that is, let's say, exploit this water ice in obviously extremely hazardous, dangerous and technically challenging environments in close proximity and doing that with different rules, having at least a uniform set of rules of the road in whatever form is one way of minimizing risks of misunderstanding and people doing the wrong thing from the perception of others.
ECS check 204.
Minus 10, 9, 8.
One thing is certain about the future of human space activity. Whether it's building orbiting data centres or mining on the moon, the certainty is that interest in such activities is only going to increase. It's not going away. I mentioned earlier about the growing concern regarding space junk and congestion in the outer atmosphere, and dealing with that junk has become a business in its own right. The preferred way of disposing of an obsolete satellite is to alter its trajectory in such a way that it disintegrates on re-entering Earth's atmosphere. But new research has called that approach into question. Daniel Murphy is with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States.
The issue is that when spacecraft and rocket boosters re-enter the atmosphere, they largely burn up, and they're intended to do that. But when things burn up, you know, not everything disappears. The aluminum, the copper, the other metals that the spacecraft are made of are still in the atmosphere. And so there's these metals being deposited in the atmosphere at high altitude, and they make their way to the stratosphere, which is lower than them burning up, and they accumulate some in the stratosphere, and we can measure them in the particles there.
So what are the main metals that are actually turning up in the stratosphere?
Well, the main ones from spacecraft are aluminum. Another one is copper, and there's other metals like iron in spacecraft. The iron we don't measure so much because there's iron from meteors, and there's a lot more iron from meteors than there are from spacecraft. And then there's a whole host of novel metals that there's a little bit of in spacecraft, including lithium, lead, tin, molybdenum, niobium, and some others.
And is the concern just the growing concentration of these vaporized metals? Because the vaporized metals come also into the atmosphere naturally, don't they, from meteors?
Right, exactly. The meteors are contributing iron, magnesium, nickel, some other metals. The concern is that these metals are new. So we're pretty sure that, you know, the atmosphere has completely responded to what meteors are doing. But these other metals are new to the atmosphere, and we really don't know what chemistry they're going to do. And it's not necessarily bad, but it's pretty uncomfortable putting something in the atmosphere when you don't know what it's going to do.
Because there could be negative impacts, considerable negative impacts for our environment.
Right, there could be.
How many satellites are being brought back to Earth and vaporized, you know, at the moment? Do we know?
The rate, and this is a rough rate right now, is about one a day on average. And people expect that in coming years with these big low Earth constellations, the rate will be more like 30 a day. there's going to be a lot more of these novel metals coming into the atmosphere than there are right now.
We know that there's going to be an increase in satellites, and we know that there is still a focus on not leaving them in space because of the problem of space debris. What do we do to try and deal with this issue?
Well, one of the things we need to try to do is figure out whether or not these metals are harmful, and if so, maybe which ones are harmful and which ones are not. And that level of research would then provide some guidance for what might be done in the future with satellites.
So it might affect the way in which satellites are designed, the kind of materials that are incorporated into them.
I'm hesitating a little here because there's a very strong focus at NOAA on not prescribing solutions, but giving good information on the problems. So what we want to be able to do is provide information that would tell us what the impacts are on the atmosphere, and then it'll probably be up to the governments to decide what to do with the information that we give them, whether or not there's action needed to change the way the spacecraft are built.
And our satellite manufacturers, are they attuned to this? Are they on board in terms of support for the research?
All I can say is that I haven't had any contact from the satellite manufacturers.
How significant is this issue? I mean, how urgent is it for us to get an understanding of the issue there?
I think the urgency is really driven by the rapid increase in the spacecraft. I mean, if there are changes that need to be made, then you'd rather get started on that soon, you know, before all these spacecraft are in orbit rather than after. And spacecraft have a long lead time on design, so you can't change the way they're built overnight either.
Would one possible benefit be extending the life of satellites, giving them a longer lifespan?
There's some very simple math there that if you have 10,000 satellites in your constellation and you turn them over every 5 years, that's 2,000 satellites a year. And if you turn them over every 10 years, that's 1,000 satellites re-entering a year. So yeah, there's some very simple math that says, you know, the fewer you bring down, the less impact on the atmosphere.
Daniel Murphy from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. And a reminder that you're with Future Tense, exploring new ideas, new approaches, and new technologies. I'm Anthony Fennell. Moving back to Earth now, and a different topic. Everybody's favourite, artificial intelligence. Yes, AI. And specifically, how it might be shaping the way we humans write, the words we use, and the way we construct our sentences. Here's socio-tech expert Ritesh Chugg from Central Queensland University.
Anthony, so I've been working in this space from December 2022. And as you know, ChatGPT was released in November 2022. It really shot to prominence really quickly. In fact, ChatGPT in 5 days had over 1 million users. And consequently, what happened was through my own work with ChatGPT and my own research work in that space, I became aware of the style of AI language models through observations of repetitive phrases or similar patterns in text outputs.
And what are the characteristics of AI-shaped and formulated writing from your observation?
I tend to see common words that keep popping up in texts that I read. In fact, there's research that shows us words like showcasing, underscore, pivotal, meticulous, tapestry, navigation, repeatedly in writing. And that's why, you know, we've become suspect because we feel it is AI-generated writing.
And those sort of words, they're quite stylistic, they're quite flowery, aren't they? They're not necessarily the sort of words that you would use in basic communication, you know, in clear communication.
Absolutely. AI-generated texts can feel inhuman due to their reliance on patterns and common phrases which they were trained on. And that's why they lack that genuine, we've sensed the lack of genuine creativity and individual expression in AI-generated writing. I mean, for instance, if a text repeatedly uses words like revolutionize, navigate, meticulous, without offering a personal perspective, it comes across as very formulaic. It lacks the emotional depth and unique voice that usually characterizes human writing.
So is the main problem here that, you know, people are using generative AI, things like ChatGPT, to actually improve their communication? At least that's what they're hoping to do. But in a sense, from what you're saying, the use of these tools don't necessarily by themselves increase the clearness of your communication.
I don't see it as a problem because we have to see AI as a tool. The tool is there for everyone to use. In fact, the problem lies in the fact when people don't use the tool. Because when we're talking ChatGPT, ChatGPT does not write for us, it writes with us. I mean, definitely we've seen efficiencies because we have to look at the positive impact of generative AI or ChatGPT on writing and communication. AI tools, and I've always maintained, and I use AI tools or generative AI tools as my virtual assistants. They've enhanced my efficiency. They help to refine drafts, improve clarity. In terms of accessibility also, people who struggle with writing, which could be non-native speakers, people with dyslexia, can now express their ideas more effectively. And AI can also be used to aid in brainstorming and provide alternative perspectives, which ultimately enhances creative writing. The reason we are seeing it as a problem is because we feel and we are seeing a lot of impact of AI in educational contexts, where we feel that users could become dependent or over-reliant on AI, which could impact critical thinking and possibly a decline in writing skills. We're also concerned about originality and authorship. The text that we see, the AI-generated text that we are seeing, because it's coming from large data sets on which the AI model was trained, it can sometimes reinforce biases or generate inaccurate information.
But as you say, it can be used to help improve communication and also language. It is a tool, again, as you've said. What sort of tips do you have for what people should do to get the best out of AI and avoid that over-flowery language?
I think the more we use it, the better we become with its use. Learning how to prompt an AI model is important. And because, as we all know, human authored text tends to display a more distinct tone. And in our day-to-day language, we incorporate informal expressions, we have varied sentence structures, and we have unique writing styles. So I think it's important for people to recognize that there are these inconsistencies that people need to be aware of. We should also have the ability to reason ourselves and detect any unnatural phrasing. So I think it's important for humans to stay in control. And I often say the future of writing is not AI versus humans. It is AI plus humans. Artificial intelligence tools can generate words, but these tools cannot generate wisdom. So it's important for us as humans to actually make sense of the AI model's writing style, ensure that the information is correct, and also edit as required. And because I do a lot of educational sessions around AI, one of the things I also say is AI can be a co-pilot for writing, but the human mind must remain in the captain's seat.
Ritesh Chugg from Central Queensland University, and another perspective on the influence of AI. Go to our website if you want further details about any of our guests we've had on today. My thanks to co-producer Karin Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.